It's Totally Football Show. Today, England Mardy after Tardy VAR, Mars Vardy Party. We round up all the midweek news that matters, including Isco Inferno, Spain's sensational 6-1 over Argentina. Then, league action. That huge Chelsea Spurs clash at the bridge featuring such diverse delights as Dele Alli. While at the other end, Saints take the field at the London Stadium, and they may not be the only ones in that big bottom four clash with West Ham. There's massive games abroad. Bayern Dortmund in Germany. And quick reminder of what a title race looks like. Juventus Milan in Italy. We'll also catch up on useful phrases for talking football next time you're in the Middle East and answer your questions in the Totally Football Show. It's a special Totally Football Show today and it features Tom Williams, author of Do You Speak Football? Tom.
Hello, James.
Yep, good. James Horncastle's here, author of absolutely nothing, James.
That is true, yeah.
It's not a book.
Thank you for bringing that up, James.
But you've got something, haven't you?
Something.
It's going to drop soon. Woof. Michael Cox, you're the author of The Mixer.
Yes, I am. Thank you, James.
Not at all. Still getting a lot of traction on social media, The Mixer.
It is. Well, it's a timeless, I wouldn't say classic,
isn't it,
but it's certainly timeless.
You're going to have to do a new chapter, though. You're going to have to do a new chapter about the Guardiola thing, no?
I think you're right. Yeah. Right. We'll need updating.
If you need any help, let me know. A lot of people writing in because they're getting married. Mm-hmm. Rhiannon and Darian getting married today. Is this the best use of an international break? Says Darian. We'll see. Andrew Lang, my best mate and avid TFS listener, Finlay Marks, is getting married up in Perth, Scotland today. He's a previous winner of Best Tweet at your live shows. Give him and his lovely wife, Sarah, a shout out from the team. You're the team, boys.
Congratulations.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a good time to get married as long as you're not going to get a call up like John Ruddy or was in that situation a few years ago.
Francesco Toldo. Do you remember? Wasn't it Toldo who had to put off his honeymoon because he got a call up?
I remember more recently Mattia Destro had to do that. Oh. Where basically Conte insisted that he come back, so what, 12 hours after getting married. Which...
Wow, that's so Conte, isn't it?
I think there was one of the Czech players in Euro 96, might have been Nedved or Poborsky or someone, but I think their wedding was the day of the final, or certainly the latter stages, and they didn't expect the Czechs to get there, which is, you know, you've got to be confident in yourself.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. All right, well, congratulations and best wishes to all. Let's turn our attention to another kind of match. Internationals. They've been playing them. Loads of big ones this midweek. Guys, I know you've been all over this Tuesday and Wednesday. Michael, should we start with Spain, who, by the way, beat Argentina 6-1? What?
Yeah, I mean, Spain were obviously the big winners of this international break. I think the other big sides either performed in a kind of manner you expect for international friendlies, a little bit flat. There's also the issue that Brazil and Argentina were both without their star players, so it's difficult to judge them. But Spain were fantastic. I mean, that game against Germany was just so high tempo and so thrilling. It was almost a good advertisement for those two, regardless of the scoreline. If they can play in that way, that high tempo, they're going to be very difficult to stop in Russia. And then the win over Argentina was just extraordinarily confident. Isco, of course, grabbed a hat-trick and was very impressive. But the fact that they played pretty much five playmakers, they didn't have Busquets, he was out injured. They played five playmakers with a back four and then a centre-forward, and they just played brilliant football. And I think we should also say that Argentina played extremely badly in that
game. How does that work, five playmakers? Is that something you could ever do in a proper match?
Well, I don't think they're far away from it. I mean, basically, Thiago came in and played the Busquets role. Uh-huh. So they didn't have what I'd call a proper holding midfielder like Busquets. They had Silva and Isco drifting in from the flanks and Alba and Carvajal providing the width. It was really impressive. But Argentina's defending, I mean, we know what Sampaoli's all about. You know, he wants to press high. He wants to use a defensive line that's close to the halfway line. And in the second half, it was like watching Andre Villas Boas sides, you know, when they just repeatedly kept getting done in behind. I'm not sure that Argentina have the players to play that way. And it really did just invite Spain's pass and move football.
Some people questioning whether Argentina's performance just underlines that they are a one-man team. Harry Middleton, for example, made that suggestion on Twitter. I mean, it's worth mentioning that they did beat Italy 2-0 without Messi in the side.
Yeah, which in the Italian press has been taken as even more humiliating now that they've just been handed their asses to them by Spain, 6-1. Yeah. It's very worrying, I think, that performance. I think, obviously, if they'd had Messi, Messi would have given the Spanish a lot more to think about. But they just got done. time and time again by the most basic of things, like a goal kick. You know, they couldn't even defend that. Or you had Willy Caballero just passing it to Iago Aspas. They were so bad. And the midfield combination that they had, Mascherano and Bilia, which, you know, hasn't really changed from what it was 4 years ago, looked really lacking in terms of mobility, which I think even top sides will against Spanish side, as Michael mentioned, has five playmakers in it. But, you know, when you're missing your star player, that's when you look to your coach to find an edge, to really show his value. And that was completely not on show at the Wanda.
From the much-admired Jorge Sampaoli.
Mm. Mm. I thought it was notable as well that in both the games against Germany and Argentina, Spain created a lot of chances from pressing high up the pitch. We don't really see that in international football. You know, we've become really accustomed to it in club football over the last few years, particularly in the Premier League with Pochettino and Klopp kind of basing their philosophy around that. But if you look at international tournaments, teams basically just retreat to the halfway line and sit there. Whereas Spain, that was really quite something, I think, the way they played. And if they carry that into the tournament in Russia, I think they'll have the edge over everyone else because just no one else really plays that way. Certainly not with that level of cohesion.
In contrast to Argentina, though, Brazil without their star man, Neymar, enjoying two wins. Are they back, Michael, for you?
I'm not sure they're back, but I think what they do have compared to Argentina is an obvious other source of creativity in Coutinho. I think they're quite a good mixture of flair and kind of, they've got solid players as well. They've got players like Willian and Paulinho who can provide something in the final third, but they're actually very hardworking. I think Brazil were far better than they were 4 years ago. I mean, you look at that side from 4 years ago, and I mean, Fred up front with Oscar just behind. I mean, it wasn't very Brazilian, was it? I think they're a lot more exciting now. And I would be surprised if they have a collapse this time like they did last time.
Well, those four nations, Spain, Argentina, Germany, Brazil, I think seen as the big four contenders with probably the addition of France, Tom, in that. You saw them midweek and their victory over Russia, which featured an Mbappe brace and a rather special free kick from Pogba, who got a rare run out.
I think looking at this international window as a whole, I think you'd say that Spain, Germany, probably Brazil look ready. I think if the World Cup kicked off in a week, they'd, okay, apart from the fact that some of them have got injured players that haven't yet come back, they look like they know what they're doing. I wouldn't put France in that bracket. I think the issue that France have is they still haven't figured out how to get all of these sensationally talented attacking players into the same team. I think the biggest issue facing France comes down to who the team is built around. Griezmann or Pogba. And what we saw against Russia was what Pogba can do when he's playing in a three. Made the first goal from Mbappe with a lovely through ball down the inside left channel. Scored a lovely free kick. First goal for club or country since November. And that was a sign of what he can do. But again, there's a feeling that France are better when Griezmann is at his best.
And when they're playing Russia. Are Russia set to be the worst host nation ever?
I mean, quite possibly.
There's only been one team in World Cup history that has hosted the tournament and not got out of the first round, which was South Africa in 2010.
There you go.
So I wouldn't be surprised if Russia follow that up.
Mr. Gribbles says, who are the panel's dark horses for the World Cup? Could Uruguay be one of them? I know you were all over the China Cup last week.
Loved it.
Wales's victory over China, which put them into the final against Uruguay.
Yeah.
Tom, did you see, was that on kind of Chelsea TV
Wales,
or something?
Wales, China.
Oh, yeah.
That was on BBC Wales, I think.
Oh, was it? Okay.
But then
the
Wales, Uruguay was only on S4C.
Wow.
And as a result, the Welsh spelling of Uruguay reached a wider audience than it would have ordinarily,
and
much
how
to the mirth
how
of
do
many
Welsh
Twitter users.
Do you have it there?
It's something that, and I should know this as a Welshman, it's something like there's a lot of W's where one might expect to find U's.
It looks like their form table or something.
It does a bit, yeah. A very impressive form table,
yeah,
given the amount of W's.
Well, and impressive is what they are. On one hand, you've got Luis Suarez, and you've also got Edson Cavani, who scored against Wales in the final, but also that overhead kick against the Czech Republic in the semi.
Yeah, and a really enjoyable overhead kick in that you saw it coming from quite some distance. The ball goes into the box. Suddenly Cavani finds himself completely free with no one, anyone around him. You know he's going to launch himself into an overhead kick, and he absolutely leathers it. Really pure connection. Very, very satisfying.
It's okay. Funny how just, I mean, these were basically friendlies, but it's funny how just putting him into a tournament makes it a bigger news. People are actually talking about the China Cup as if it's a thing.
Mm.
You know,
is it like not a tournoi?
No, honestly, I think this is a genuine prediction. Within 5 or 6 years, these international friendlies, they'll do loads of that, but they'll do it in London. They'll just have like a two-game tournament and just create something around it. As we said on last week's show, if you put an event on in London,
people will come.
People go. Yeah. I went to Craven Cottage and there was 15,000 Colombians there. Yeah. It's incredible.
Mm. All right. Mr. Gribbles, though, was asking for your dark horses just on that Uruguay subject and their potential candidacy for such a role. Their group, do you know what this is? Their group is Russia, Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to name a dark horse? Or
in theory, Belgium should be a dark horse.
They
should be because they're coached by Roberto Martinez. Ah. So they're going to have to overcome that in order to do anything. And I think this is a major issue for
Michael,
them.
A dark horse?
They're in a tough...
Say German if you want, apparently.
Never count out the Germans. They're in a tough group. I think Morocco actually got a good
Morocco,
side.
Morocco, on what basis? Briefly.
6 qualification games, 6 clean sheets.
Ooh.
But they're in a group with Spain and Portugal, which is the tough.
Well, although Portugal got beaten by Netherlands and they don't beat anybody.
Yeah, that is true.
3-0, first game in 9 matches that Cristiano Ronaldo didn't score. He got subbed off for João Moutinho, but he was happy about that. What do you think, Tom? Who's your dark horse?
Probably can't really call them dark horses, seeing as they are the reigning European champions. But, I mean, why not Portugal? They are the reigning European champions. They've got a very solid, very rugged team. They've got a match winner. I wouldn't put any money on them, but I think if you're looking outside the usual contenders, Portugal aren't really being talked about as potential champions, I don't think, too much.
All right. Scotland beat Hungary 1-0.
Probably won't be Scotland.
Not going to be Scotland, you think? First win for Alex McLeish, that Matt Phillips with the goal. They also missed a penalty. Good stuff. And, of course, England were playing at Wembley against Italy. Wayne Edge asks, it sounds like Ben Green, producer Ben, doing the stadium announcing at Wembley. Am I wrong? You are so very wrong, Wayne, but this is what he does sound like.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power, the home of the Money Back Special. Keep listening to the end of the podcast to find out more.
Thanks, producer Ben. WRWGWAI. Tom, spells?
Uruguay.
And that's... Okay, so it's pronounced the same
way. It's pronounced roughly the same way. It's a bit more W-E.
Right.
I'd say.
Okay. Good to have you here for that. England, a 1-1 draw with Italy. We are obliged to have reached conclusions about this.
Uh-huh.
Don't know how many.
How many?
I don't know. How many do you think? I've got Vardy's much more use when he's got the ball. That's one. And, here's another one. England can't afford to defend at a World Cup like that because they're unlikely perhaps to be up against opponents as forgiving as Ciro Immobile.
Yeah, I think Immobile could have had, what, 2 or 3 goals in the first 15 minutes?
Could have been on a hat trick.
Unable to translate his very good club form, which has him in the running for the Golden Boot this season at international level.
He never looks... I mean, for me, he never looks like he's going to do it either. Do you agree? Michael, you're nodding.
I know exactly what you mean. He's unconvincing. Yeah.
Yeah. More reason to call up Mario Balotelli.
Well, yeah, I have to agree with you.
But yeah, the Italians were not all that impressed by England. They thought, given what they'd heard about them from the Holland game and given how down they are about themselves after the Argentina game, they fully expected to get beat in this one. And so to have, for a good first 20 minutes and then a fairly decent final quarter of an hour... That was more than they expected, and also I think they just looked at England's midfield and just thought they've got no one who can pass the ball at all. Essentially, you know, they've just got two wingers playing in midfield, and the only way they can get the ball up the pitch is by running it up the pitch with the likes of Rashford, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Lingard, Vardy, and that's the only way. So it makes it very difficult for England, particularly against better opposition than Italy, to control the game because they've got no one really.
Is that a fair criticism?
I think the one thing that I would say about England, the one positive thing I'd say, is that at least we know how they're going to play at the World Cup. And I don't think going into any of the last three tournaments you've been able to say that. It was the great irony of Roy Hodgson's tenure, that a manager who had made his name on team organisation and team shape and everyone in his teams knowing exactly what they were supposed to be doing was unable to translate that to England. And we had all these really weird selection issues. I remember the 2014 World Cup, prior to the opening game against Italy, who's going to play at number 10? Is it Rooney? Is it Sterling? Rooney ends up out on the left. Sterling plays in the middle. They'd not really tried that before. Euro 2016, Wayne Rooney starts his first ever match in midfield for his country in the opening game against Russia. So all these decisions being taken on the fly. I mean, England clearly have lots of weaknesses, chiefly in central midfield. But at least 3 months out for the tournament, there is a very clear strategy. There is a style of play. There's a system. You know, we now know what to expect. The players know what to expect. And that's a much firmer foundation than they've had for a while.
All right.
And part of that, without wanting to be too unkind, is the fact that Rooney's not there. I mean, I think England spent the last 5 years of Rooney's international career trying to crowbar him into the side, despite the fact he wasn't, you know, wasn't that useful in any position. I think his retirement has worked really well for England. And sometimes, I'm not saying this will spur England on, but sometimes you look at, you know, big names that have fallen out of the reckoning. Spain became very good after Raul quit the national side, having, you know, the side based around him. Germany with Ballack in 2010, that was the catalyst for them. So I do think Rooney clearing off really has done England quite well.
Who's the player you take out of the Italy side, James, to suddenly unleash their potential?
Well, a lot of the focus was on Gianluigi Buffon before this international break, and yet he was their best player against Argentina.
All right. Well, this was the last game before Gareth Southgate, who's been very impressive, certainly off the field, as well as, you know, not doing too badly on the bench. Last game before he has to pick his provisional squad. That's on the 14th of May. The final squad announced on the 4th of June. There's friendlies coming up against Nigeria, hopefully in their exciting new kit. Did you enjoy that?
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
Do you like
it? Flashback to what sort of, it's a combination between the 94 and 98 ones.
It's like a test card or something, you know, for what. Yeah. Anyway, they'll also be taking on Costa Rica. Yeah.
Mm.
Because, you know, 6 degrees of Costa Rica, everybody plays Costa Rica. They lost 1-0 to Tunisia, who of course are in England's group.
Okay, so that was preparation for them. That's for Panama. Excellent,
right. Panama, by the way, they had a game midweek. It's also from England's group. Keep up, everyone. They lost 6-0 to Switzerland.
Yeah, I gather they're not very good and are very physical.
Ah, okay. And Belgium, who beat Saudi Arabia 4-0.
Dark horses.
There you go.
Who did keep two clean sheets, which was reassuring after they'd shipped, what, I think six in the November friendlies.
Mm. So, who was in goal for them?
It wasn't Thibaut because he had his hamstring problem.
Mignolet. Perhaps that was it. Maybe clearing Courtois out the side has finally lifted the monkey off their backs. Premier League, everybody, after this.
Naeem's corner, taken short. Here he is again. And Lineker! Far too much room.
Hear that? That's what Spurs winning at Chelsea sounds like from all the way back in far off 1990. Woof! Two sides go again this Sunday at Stamford Bridge. Is Tottenham's disastrous run there going to continue? Who wants this one?
Well, I mean, if you look at the recent form...
Yes.
OK, Chelsea had a decent win against Leicester in the Cup before the international break, but they've only won 3 of their last 9 in the league.
What?
They've lost 4 of the last 6. Spurs unbeaten in 12 in the league. So, you know, maybe now's the time.
Right. Chelsea recently losing to Man United and Man City. Of course, part of the result of that has been the fact they've dropped off the pace in the top four race. There's 5 points between currently Spurs in fourth place and Chelsea. So a Spurs win here, were it to come, could really leave Chelsea in severe danger of not being anywhere near the Champions League next season. But a victory for Conte's side takes them to within 2 points. Kane, there were pictures of him training without any kind of protection on the injured ankle. Is he potentially going to be available for this?
I don't know because I'm not a medical professional and I haven't had access to his records.
Okay.
With Son in such good form, you know, with what, 7 goals in his last 5 games for Spurs, that, you know, they're finding goals in other areas. They're not so dependent on Kane as when he first had an ankle injury at the start of last season, all the way back. Also, I remember when Spurs last beat Chelsea at White Hart Lane, one of the real problems that they caused them was sort of Eriksen getting into that sort of inside right channel, crossing it into to the far post where Ali caused all kinds of problems, but basically getting in between Azpilicueta and Victor Moses. So, yeah, I think he scored two goals from doing that. So that's an area that they might again look to explore. I'm quite curious to see whether Spurs actually play Alderweireld in this game, because he did start in midweek for Belgium. We've all been told he's injured.
Right.
And it's not about this contract dispute that there is between him and
is there a contract dispute?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Because if he goes into the next year, there's a 25 million buyout clause. So obviously that's very cheap in today's market. But yeah, he wants the club to pay him what he's worth. And as one of the best players and best centre-backs in the Premier League, he's definitely worth more than the wage that he's on at the moment. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Chelsea potentially with all sorts of absences at the back. You mentioned Courtois, also Christensen, who missed Denmark's game with Panama.
Well, he was sent back because of fatigue.
Because
he was just so tired after this. This very busy start to 2018. And remember, you know, he was coming back from his loan spell at Gladbach the last couple of years, where they have a very big winter break, so actually having to play through the Christmas and New Year period, I think really took it out of him.
I think this is potentially the biggest game of the Premier League season between Chelsea and Tottenham, because the title's title has been done for months.
Yeah,
I think it's highly unlikely United and Liverpool will fall out of the Champions League places. Arsenal aren't really in the running. These sides, you know, this is the difference between Spurs being 8 points ahead and 2 points ahead. That last Champions League place is, you know, pretty much all that we're playing for. I think it's a really big game, actually. And I think Tottenham could well win. I think they're just a much better team than Chelsea at the moment. They're more organised. Kane's absence is a blow, but I think Son has played really well running the channels. I think he could stretch that three-man defence quite nicely. Tottenham will be quite solid and compact because a draw isn't a bad result for them. But part of the reason they haven't ever won at Chelsea is because they've rarely been a better side than Chelsea. Mm. And they are at the moment.
They've taken the lead on the last two visits.
Well,
the
2 years ago was that famous 2-2, no?
Yeah, where they were 2-0 up. And also, it was the season before that, they were 1-0 up as well.
Uh-huh.
From a Chelsea standpoint, one of the kind of, let's quote-unquote, masterstrokes that Conte did earlier in the season when they played, you know, obviously they'd lost the first game of the season to Burnley, and then this was the second one at Wembley, and there was already seemingly quite a lot of pressure on Conte. He put Luiz in midfield. And they had quite a physical midfield of Bakayoko, Kante and Luiz, which stopped Spurs doing what they're really good at. Luiz seems to have fallen completely out of favour for the most part with Conte, so I don't know whether he's basically not going to be able to go to that option anymore. Fabregas didn't play in that game. He was obviously a little bit more lightweight. So I think that could be a kind of key area in where this game is won and lost.
4 o'clock on Sunday, they face off at Stamford Bridge in the biggest game of the season. I mean, you make a compelling case, Michael.
I mean, there's not been that many big games throughout Europe, you know, in the big leagues, because the leagues are pretty much done, with the exception of Serie A.
Yeah.
I can't remember any really big, exciting games that have defined this Premier League season, because City have just streaked off into the distance. It's been a bit of a shame, really.
Mm. Well, there are some big games coming up this weekend. We'll talk more about some of the continental fixtures later on. But another biggie in the Premier League sees top four side Liverpool, who are currently in third spot, but can go second. They've played a game more than Man United, are currently in that position. But they are away at Palace, a fixture redolent in memories and regrets, of course, for Liverpool. 5th of May 2014, 3-0 up with 11 minutes to go, and it ends in a draw, and Luis Suarez in tears on the Selhurst Park turf.
I was there, actually.
Were you there, Tom?
I'd not been to Selhurst Park before, so they put me in the overspill press box.
Brilliant.
This is not to have a go at Palace, they're lovely people, you get very well looked after, but I was in the overspill press box. I didn't have a plug for my laptop or a video replay screen.
The real victim.
So when Liverpool fell apart at the end, the real victim, the sort of the 12th victim, I didn't really know what was going on. So it was kind of enjoyable, but also quite stressful.
How often do you find that in a game in which events unfold rapidly at the finish, that you're actually writing a report without a clear sense of what on earth has just happened?
If you're writing a runner, a match report that has to go on the whistle, miss a surprising amount of things.
Can you ask the bloke next to you?
That's inevitably what happens quite a lot of the time. The worst thing is when you've already filed your report and you go down into the press box and you're chatting with someone about the game, and they're talking about some substitute who came on in the 82nd minute and really made an impact, and you didn't even realise.
Do you ever do that? Do you ever make stuff up just to really
I wouldn't go so far. Oh, to make yourself up to other people. Oh, yeah, yeah. All the time. Yeah. You spotted that injury time goal, yeah? Yeah, that's always fun.
I wouldn't last 2 seconds in that environment.
Well, Jose Mourinho says one of the great satisfactions of his job is that late goal and just the vision of journalists in the press box having to delete everything that they've just written.
Really?
Yeah. If that's one of his great satisfactions, bloody hell.
Oh, my word. Do you know, it's not just that game. Palace actually have a terrific record against Liverpool. They've won 6 of their last 12.
They've lost the last 3 at Selhurst Park. They've lost everyone since Chris Dambul now at Selhurst Park. Palace have.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Palace got that win against
Huddersfield,
pre-international break, ending a run of 7 games without a win. Zaha's back.
Yep.
More of those injured players are coming back as well. So, I mean, obviously, you know, you back Liverpool to get a result there, but Palace are looking a lot better than they were.
I'm not sure that it's that cut and dry. Palace have sprung surprises already earlier this season. Chelsea, very famously. And they almost got a draw with Arsenal. I mean, which, yeah, it's less impressive. Your revenge narratives. You got Roy Hodgson, of course, who had a less than happy spell at Anfield. Benteke as well. Sacco. God, they've all got points to prove, haven't they? It's going to be like an Agatha Christie novel.
Well, both Benteke and Hodgson have good records against Liverpool. Benteke scored 6 in 8 against Liverpool, and Hodgson's won 3 in 5. I think it's a tough game for Liverpool, actually. I think Palace, I mean, their injury worries have eased a little bit. I think when Zaha's in the team, they're just so exciting. I think it'll be a tough game for Liverpool.
It's a lunchtime kickoff this weekend. I do like a lunchtime kickoff.
Slight danger that Liverpool might have half an eye on Man City in the Champions League.
It's a huge week for Liverpool because they've got City on Wednesday and then they've got the derby next weekend. What do you think? Palace to do one of those special Super Eagles matches?
No, I think it's. I think Liverpool can do this. I think it's just so hard to stop Liverpool from scoring. And, you know, you get. If you get into a game where you're looking to be, what, win 4-3 or 5-4, it's very difficult. So I think Liverpool have got this.
Salah with 4 goals in his last appearance.
Well, he's scored in 2/3 of the games he's played in the Premier League this season, 20 out of 30 games,
wow,
which is pretty extraordinary.
Palace, of course, are only 2 points above the drop. Stoke, who are 3 points from safety, are at Arsenal, who themselves might have one eye on their upcoming European fixture when they'll be hosting CSKA Moscow on Thursday. They've never won at the Emirates, Stoke.
I mean, even worse, they've lost every single game. 9 out of 9. Yeah, I think Arsenal will win that.
But Paul Lambert has won at the Emirates Stadium with Aston Villa on the opening day back in, what, 2013-14.
Remarkable.
Yeah, but they will be without Charlie Adam after his ridiculous red card against Everton. And some Stoke fans wondering where they're going to get some creativity. Remember they signed that guy Ibrahim Afellay?
Yes.
Who's part of their kind of Stoke loner, sort of let's get Bojan, let's get Mark Munyesa. Apparently they're not going to be able to call on him because they've told him to just stay away from the training ground.
Stay away.
Yeah.
Wow, that's brutal.
Yeah, so there's that. And also, Eric Peters, one of their defenders, was caught at a nightclub before the Everton game. So he was, I think, given a fine for that. So all these sort of things,
not helping, really.
Where was the nightclub? It wasn't in Stoke,
well,
was
that's
it?
The thing, yeah. I wonder about that. So
they just have darts clubs in Stoke, surely.
No, there's definitely at least one nightclub because Eddie Hall famously was a bouncer at a nightclub in
really?
Stoke. So now, they are in some trouble, Stoke, and likely to remain so from what you're saying. West Ham and Saints is the really interesting game down there at the bottom because West Ham and Saints, the two teams on either side of that dotted line towards the bottom of your league table, separated currently by just the 2 points and facing each other at the London Stadium. It's the first game that West Ham will have there since all the unpleasantness, Tom.
Yes, yes. I mean, West Ham obviously a real low ebb at the moment. That remarkable game against Burnley and the scenes that came with it. I think 20 fans have been given life bans by the club, and Mark Noble has written an open letter to the fans calling for unity. And Southampton in a similarly perilous position in terms of league form, but of course, now under new management, Mark Hughes came in, won his first game away at Wigan in the Cup, which hasn't been an easy place to go for the big teams in the Cup this season. So Southampton go into it with a little bit of momentum. Hughes will have had time on the training ground over the international break to get his ideas across. So it could be another thorny one for West Ham. I mean, you dread to think what would happen if they put in another poor performance. I mean, they've lost the last three games by three goals. If they take another heavy defeat, it could be unpleasant.
In terms of instant impact, Mark Hughes hasn't won his first Premier League game at a club since 2004.
Really? Of course, he did get his debut win in the FA Cup for Southampton.
This is strictly Premier League, I'm talking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it the most faded from glory managerial meeting possible, this, with Hughes, who was once the manager of Man City, and Moyes, who was once the manager of Man United, and now there they are, eking out an existence at the bottom end of the pile?
Yeah, to say, I mean, it's not bad to be managing the Premier League.
No, you're right, it isn't.
You know.
It absolutely isn't.
In the grand scheme, I think.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Right. Excellent.
I mean, Southampton are a little bit bold, or at least that's what you'd take from the starting 11 that we saw against Wigan, in that they went with two strikers rather than one, in terms of, we saw Gabbiadini and Carrillo.
Yeah.
And just, he's trying to get as much quality into the team as possible. Maybe take the handbrake off in terms of playing Tadic and Bufal as well.
So. I'm getting breaking news, Charlie Austin back available for Southampton. That really changes the whole paradigm.
He's still their top scorer, and he's been out for months.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
Because he got one.
I believe you're right.
Yeah.
Now, there's loads more Premier League to come, but after this, we're going to talk fancy foreign stuff.
Listeners, you know there's more to football than false nines, back threes, and deciding who's your number one, number one. Yes, football's fundamentally a simple game, but you can't understand football without understanding the modern world, and you can't understand the modern world without understanding its most popular sport. Game of Our Lives is a new podcast series hosted by the football historian David Goldblatt. It tackles themes like human nature, globalisation and geopolitics through the prism of the beautiful game, just like the Totally Football Show, sort of, and you can bet we'll be listening. Last week's episode featured Godwin Enakena, the sporting director at Mountain of Fire and Miracles FC, and focused on the humble roots of a team which has taken Nigerian football by storm. Well, this week, David speaks to Shireen Ahmed about how women, people of colour and other minorities are challenging institutional bias in football. Shireen is both a player and a coach in her native Toronto. She's also the author of the Tales from a Hijabi Footballer blog and spent years working to overturn FIFA's ban on women wearing headscarves.
March 1st, 2014, I remember exactly where I was at that moment. I was in rural Nova Scotia visiting my best friend Catherine in her home, and the wood pellet stove was on, and I remember looking at my phone and my hand started trembling. And I had to sit down, and she's like, "Are you okay? What happened?" And I said, "You know, FIFA is allowing hijab." She's like, "Yes, this is what we want, right? Isn't this a good thing?"
If you want to learn more about why football matters, make sure you listen to Game of Our Lives on Apple Podcasts and everywhere else you get your audio on demand. The Game of Our Lives podcast with David Goldblatt. Subscribe now.
Very interesting. Tom, your book, Do You Speak Football, which is out when?
May 3rd.
May 3rd. Does it have any good phrases used in Middle Eastern football?
It has a few. Would you like to hear them?
Well, yes.
We'll start off in Qatar.
Yeah.
The thob is the name of the long white shirt that Qatari men
play. The tunic.
The tunic.
Yeah, okay.
If you're wearing one of these garments and you're having a kick about and you prevent an opponent from nutmegging you by blocking the path of the ball with the hem of your thobe, that is a foul thobe.
Oh, come on.
That's what it is.
They genuinely call it a foul thobe.
Yeah. Well, it's underhand. You can't get away with nut. You can't avoid a nutmegging.
But how would you do that? How would you use the hem to prevent the...
Well, I guess if you wear one on a day-to-day basis, you're probably quite adept at
flicking it
around. So, you know, quick readjustment.
All right, let's move on. What do they call stepovers in the Middle East?
An Arabic term for stepovers is marwaha, which is an electric fan.
Brilliant.
So the idea being that the legs of the attacking player resemble the whirring blades of a fan. Another one I quite like is mazaria, which means vase, and a vase is a statuesque goalkeeper.
Okay.
Shot flies past him, doesn't move, looks like a vase.
Right.
And if it hits him, breaks him?
Or? I think they probably use a different word for that.
Okay.
I'll have to check. And then
different kind of vase problems, of course.
Yeah.
A final one, if you send a shot sailing over the crossbar, that's known as yasir hamam, which means to hunt pigeons.
Oh, yeah.
Ball sailing into orbit. So there you go.
Excellent. That's fascinating. Fans of football trivia, by the way, sound the klaxon. I'm afraid there's no Totally Football quiz this Friday. There's not a drill. It's Easter Friday. We won't be doing one. But there are apparently all sorts of lovely things going on at facebook.com/thetotallyshow, as long as you don't mind everybody in big business knowing your entire life's worth of kind of digital. Anyway. Football League news. Nottingham Forest owner Evangelos Marinakis has been cleared, hooray, of forming a Greek match-fixing ring, but he's still facing the possibility of being charged for bribery and drug trafficking. I'm sure he's misunderstanding. He certainly denies those accusations.
Can we stay in Greece? Because there is breaking news where the gun-toting PAOK president has been banned for 3 years. PAOK have been docked 3 points.
Oh, really? That blows the whole Greek title race wide open again, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Crikey. In other owners of clubs news, especially owners of Football League clubs in the Nottinghamshire area, Carolyn Radford, the CEO of Mansfield Town, she was in here. She was on the Totally Football League show. Here is a little taster of that. It's what she had to say about the recent departure of their manager, controversies, and indeed Peterborough's now, Steve Evans.
We recruited Steve's team in the summer. You know, we heavily invested into the squad, and it was quite a bit of a shock, to be honest. I know that his family are from Peterborough. He gets on very well with Barry Fry. That was his decision, and so we've had to move on. But, you know, with 12 games to go, we were kind of... Oh,
that sounds excellent. That was on Tuesday's Football League show. Wednesday brought you Golazzo, an extended, it might be in a slightly too extensive, I'm not sure, examination of the career of Zdenek Zeman. And also, we talk a bit about Italy's game at Wembley. And also, we look forward a little bit to the huge match coming up Saturday evening in Italy. James.
Yeah, it's a massive game, James, because Milan, who are unbeaten, I think, in 2018, at least in the league, and have the second best record in Serie A.
Who's got the best record?
Juventus.
Ah.
have the opportunity to be the kingmaker in this title race, insofar as they play both Juventus and Napoli. Between now and, I think, the sort of top of the table clash at the end of April. The only sort of spanner in those works is that Milan, since the opening of the Juventus Stadium, have never won there. The last time that Milan managed to beat Juventus
was the goal scored by their current manager, Gennaro Gattuso?
Yes, and their win was masterminded by their former manager, Massimiliano Allegri.
No way, who's currently managing, of course, the team they're going to be facing.
Exactly, and of course, the sort of extra reason, if you like, to watch this is to see what reception Leonardo Bonucci gets.
Oh, Bonucci's
on
first
his
time
return.
Back. Yeah.
To
you know, it's an interesting time for Milan. They have continued that unbeaten run, 10 games now in Serie A. But they've got a derby on Wednesday against Inter. That's huge because they're 5 points behind Inter in the race for a Champions League place. Win that, and obviously, all of a sudden, it's a very, very real prospect. But they've also got the local police department. Basically, they're investigating the takeover for money laundering. This has been hinted at for a long time, but apparently now it's officially happening. The sale of the club and the money that came in from China, what many felt was an extremely inflated figure. The Guardia di Finanza are now looking into it as a potential case of money laundering. Mm. Also this weekend, by the way, Napoli, who are just 2 points behind Juve, so should Juve slip up, Napoli can go back on top. They're away at Sassuolo earlier in the day.
Yeah, which could be a tricky game because just as much as Napoli are fighting for the title, Sassuolo are fighting for survival. And Napoli did not come out of this international break completely unscathed in that Marek Hamšík picked up an injury, but also their right back, Elsaid Hissai, had a bit of a niggle on his knee. He should be fit for this game, but if they were to lose him along with their left back, Fawzi Ghulam, that would be quite a problem for them.
So it's a question of his eye fit.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. All right then. Okay, now obviously we're going to be all over. I say obviously, but you might not know this. Saturday, March 31st is a very special day on BT Sport, full Italian, starting off with a special kind of mini Gazzetta show at, I believe, 10:45 on Saturday morning. Well, you'll be there. Myself, Gab Marcotti, is joining us for that. We're previewing a bit all the action coming up, looking back at some of the best bits of the season so far, a bit of chat. Shortly after that, we go live from the Dall'Ara in Bologna with Bologna-Roma.
Yeah, where Eusebio Di Francesco Sr. will probably come up against Di Francesco Jr.
Wow.
Yeah, who's playing for Bologna.
So. Crikey. And then we take a bit of a break, but then we return with Der Klassiker.
In the Bundesliga.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, yeah, can that reopen the title race in Germany?
Probably not.
Probably not, no.
But Bayern can seal the title. If Schalke don't register a point at home to Freiburg earlier on, Bayern can win their sixth consecutive title there. But it's going to be a fantastic game because it's Bayern and it's Borussia Dortmund, it's Lewandowski, it's Batshuayi, it's all that kind of stuff. Also going on BT Sport that day, you've got the French League Cup final, which is PSG against Monaco. Boom, Tom. Is the French League Cup final a big deal in France?
Yes, well, it's the first major trophy of the season.
Good.
Much as it is in England. PSG and Monaco met in last season's final. PSG won quite convincingly 4-1, but ended up being seen as a bit of a Pyrrhic victory almost, in that they'd lost out to Monaco in the title race. This time around, obviously, PSG, a bit of a wounded beast after going out of the Champions League. We know that Unai Emery's not going to stick around for very long. They've won their last 13 domestic games and they are 17 points clear of Monaco in the table. So you'd have them as favourites, but Monaco are on a decent run of form themselves. They've only lost one of their last 19 in all competitions. They look like they've wrapped up second place in Ligue 1. There was a time when they, Lyon, Marseille, were all basically on the same number of points. Monaco have since gone on quite a good run. So you'd still fancy PSG to win, but Monaco are in decent nick.
All right, excellent. Okay, well, that's going on. As I say, there's also Der Klassiker, and we finish off at 7:45 with that Juve Milan game live from the Juventus Stadium. Mm-hmm. Another Allianz Stadium. It's now called the Allianz Stadium, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yeah,
yes.
So it's another Allianz. So, you know, straight from one Allianz thing to another. And then after that, so massive day of Italian football. And then at 10 o'clock, for anyone who's not watching that boxing business, 10 o'clock, the Golazzo documentary airs.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting.
Hope we haven't worn you out by that stage with so much calcio, you know.
Well, I suppose it's a risk, isn't it?
It is.
Do join us then for all of that. This is 10:45. And some people are asking, is this Gazetta show, 10:45, Saturday morning, is going to be in any way, if it's a forerunner of a regular thing? To which I say, as far as I know, not. But, you know, if loads of people were to watch it at 10:45 on Saturday morning, then you'd have to think that BT would go, Saturday morning show.
I'm happy with Soccer AM, James.
I think they'd bring, yeah. Sean Slater's got a question, and it is, does anyone have a copy of the email the hacker sent to Lazio? I could do with a few quid. Sean. Oh, go on, tell us the story here, James.
Well, Feyenoord are wondering where the final €2 million of Stefan De Vrij's transfer is, because I think, as Il Tempo have it, the Rome newspaper, Lazio claim to have paid it. But what happened is they got two seemingly identical emails. The only thing is that they had different IBAN numbers on them, and one was genuine from Feyenoord, the other was from a hacker.
So someone who had knowledge of the whole deal and its timings basically inserted themselves into this and ran away with the last tranche of payment.
Reportedly, yes.
Can they not trace where that payment's gone to?
Well, you'd hope so, wouldn't you? This is doubly damaging, if you like, for Lazio, because Stefan De Vrij is at the end of his contract and will be going probably to Inter for free at the end of the season. So it's not like they can, you know, just lump on some of that transfer fee to pay for this one. But quite an unusual story, that one.
Certainly is. Speaking of unusual stories, fans of footballers picking up injuries in curious manners will have been delighted, and I think fans of football in general will have been saddened, meanwhile, by the news that Carlos Tevez had picked up a knock in unusual circumstances. Have you seen this story, Tom?
I have. He had gone to visit his brother.
Half-brother, I believe.
His half-brother, who was incarcerated in Argentina.
Mm.
And they had a kickabout with some of the inmates.
Yes.
Who didn't hold back in their challenges, and Carlos Tevez picked up some sort of injury.
Yes. Well, that's,
that's about as much detail as we can muster. Is on a par with
he's now out of action for Boca, isn't he?
Mm.
So Boca are less than happy about this.
Oh, yeah, you'd think.
Yeah. Right, OK. But it's a nice gesture of him to stage a kick around with the inmates, who, of course, need something positive in their life. I'm just saying that.
It's a Carlos Tevez thing to do, isn't it?
It is.
You imagine he probably hangs out at the prison most weekends.
Have you done anything for inmates worldwide, Michael?
Oh, well, someone tweeted me last week to say they'd tried to hire my book from Durham Library and it was being rented to prison.
Oh, okay. But,
yeah.
There you go. Well, that's good.
Different kind of mixer.
Now, more Premier League after this.
Listeners, do you like shaving and looking smooth and clean?
Yes!
But do you enjoy having to go to the shops for new razors and other shaving supplies?
No!
Well, Cornerstone gives you everything you need for a great shave and they'll deliver it all right to your door. Cornerstone's super sharp, award-winning blades are engineered in Germany, which is always a good sign, and their range of balms, creams and exfoliators are all environmentally friendly, alcohol-free and suitable for the most sensitive skin. Get £10 off your first order and check out the range for yourself at cornerstone.co.uk/totally and find out why tens of thousands of men have switched over to Cornerstone.
Premier League news, everybody. I know you're wondering what's going to happen between Newcastle and Huddersfield. Huddersfield are 3 points clear of safety. Newcastle a whopping 4. Producer Ben asks, are we ever going to see Islam Slimani? Are we?
Well, Newcastle don't really look like they necessarily need him at the moment. You know, decent run of form. What are they? What 2 defeats in the last 10 in the league and a pretty convincing 3-0 win against Southampton before the international break. So, you know, they're actually looking in pretty decent nick even without Slimani.
Excellent. Not looking in decent nick are West Brom, who host Burnley. But potentially the Baggies could do the double over the Clarets because they're one of only 3 teams, Burnley, that West Brom have beaten this season. Still, they are 7 points adrift with 7 to play, and this could be their 7th straight defeat, very possibly, in a week of bad news for West Brom, with their chief executive, Mark Jenkins, looking in their books and discovering there's no money there. He says he's shocked. There's no more money for wages. The club's going to need its first overdraft in more than 10 years. I don't recall them spending a lot of money in terms of transfers. Have they just been giving...
Is this why they couldn't afford a taxi on that...
Hey! Yeah, maybe it's bail. Maybe that's where the money's gone.
Well, I'm not sure about West Brom spending, but Pulis is a bit of a sneaky big spender. There was a time at Stoke where if you looked at the net spend for a 5-year period, the top 3 spenders in the league were Man City, Chelsea and Stoke.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether he did something similar at West Brom, but I'm not sure he's necessarily one for balancing the books.
Right, OK. Anyway, speaking of spending money on Bale, segueing on nice to do, Man United, who are taking on Swansea. That Bale story, we keep seeing it reported. Previously, it was the fact that Luke Shaw and Gareth Bale share an agent and therefore Mourinho's appalling mistreatment of Luke Shaw has led said agent and indeed Gareth Bale to think, oh, I don't want any part of that. But certainly today, Thursday, there seem to be all sorts of people saying, oh, yeah, Mourinho's tempted Gareth Bale to Old Trafford. Do any of you know anything about this? Does that make sense? Well, where would they field him?
I mean, signing Sanchez made no
left
sense.
Back.
Like for like.
Signing Sanchez made no sense, really. They still did it.
Mm.
So why not Bale? Just add more the merrier.
Real Madrid do have a habit of signing whoever has just played very well at the World Cup. 2002 Ronaldo, 2006 Cannavaro, 2010 Ozil, 2014 James Rodriguez.
Okay.
And as a response, they tend to get someone who's a pretty good team player, but not quite a big enough name as their newcomer, and just, you know, send him off to wherever they can. So it's the kind of summer where you can get someone pretty knockdown value from Real Madrid. I think the other candidate is probably Isco, who had
they
a bit
surely
of,
wouldn't get rid of.
Well,
Isco.
He had a bit of a sneaky dig at Zidane after his hat trick in midweek. Said, yes, I just feel comfortable for Spain. The coach believes in me. I don't know what's happening at Real or something along those lines. So,
Wow. Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if either of those two was to depart, perhaps with Neymar coming in.
Yeah. Man United are facing Swansea Saturday afternoon in a Portuguese manager off. Carvalhal is a similarly Lusitanian. Since his appointment on December the 28th, Swansea have had big wins over Liverpool and Arsenal. Just 1 defeat in 5 matches in the league. Is this visit to Old Trafford going to continue their fine form, panel?
No, I don't think so.
Really?
Well, I mean, both of those big wins that you mentioned against top 6 sides did come at the Liberty rather than away. And United do have a pretty formidable record at Old Trafford under Jose Mourinho. So I think it's not the biggest jump biggest sort of bet to make, but I would say United can would be quite comfortable in this, given I think aggregate scoreline this season over the league and League Cup is 6-0 to United.
6-0, that's true. Do you know who's a Swansea fan, Michael? I mean, lots of people, but who... News broke this week of a high-profile celebrity from overseas.
Haven't heard this, no.
Is this Oprah Winfrey?
Bingo, Tom Williams. Do you know why?
No.
Because she's recently made Disney kind of young adult fiction flick A Wrinkle in Time, which I've not seen but have no inclination to rectify that, in which she shares screen time with Mindy Kaling, or Carling, I'm not sure how you say that, and Mindy Kaling, or Carling, owns shares in Swansea City FC.
Ah.
Good for her. Producer Ben, who's literally on fire right now, says, I'm surprised Oprah's not a Fiorentina fan, the colour purple and all that. Of course, on that whole Hollywood Premier League axis, you've also got Sylvester Stallone, who famously enjoys a cup of coffee at Goodison.
Yep.
Tom Hanks, Aston Villa fan.
That's true.
Along with David Cameron, when he's not West Ham.
Yeah, to go and bring that up.
Russell Crowe, isn't he? Has some kind of sympathy for Leeds as well.
Does he?
Yeah. Who's now auctioning off a lot of his sort of memorabilia because he's getting divorced. So you can get the gladiator chariot for something like 25.
The actual chariot?
The actual chariot, yeah, for about 25 grand. Good bit of garden ornament there.
Well, that's amazing, isn't it?
The chariot that had the gas canister in that you can see in the film. There's a scene in Gladiator where a chariot falls on its side and you can very clearly see a gas canister in it.
Really?
Yeah.
What was that useful? Was it a fire extinguisher or something?
Don't know.
Or did it power the blades that came... Did it have blades that came out of the wheels?
I don't think it was one of the blades ones. No.
On the subject of the gas, my friend went to Bristol Rovers recently.
Seamless.
And thank you.
Seamless.
And my friend went to Bristol Rovers recently and saw Kelsey Grammer there.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it actually Kelsey Grammer?
Yeah, yeah. Apparently his wife is British and I think her dad is a director or something.
Of Bristol Rovers?
Of Bristol Rovers, yeah.
That is remarkable.
Thank you.
I can't possibly top that. Mm. Can you, James?
I mean, I've already come out with Russell Crowe, so...
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. Anyway, more Premier League fixtures. Brighton taking on Leicester. Brighton can actually move within 3 points of Leicester if they win. Houghton did win Manager of the Month for February, so presumably they're due a rotten run of... results. And in fact, they lost against United last time out. Watford are taking on Bournemouth, and Everton host Man City. If Man City win that game, you know what that means, don't you, James Horncastle?
They can win the title when they play against United.
That is absolutely true. Yeah. But although you'd think, well, Everton, what chance do they have against Man City? Hold on, because Tom Williams.
Everton are one of only three teams to have gone to the Etihad this season and not lost in all competitions.
Wow.
Can you name the other two?
Well, Liverpool. Oh, no, hang on. No. The other two who went there. Yeah, Shakhtar Donetsk.
No.
Didn't they get a draw?
They won in Kharkiv.
Bristol City?
No.
Wigan?
No.
So two teams have gone to the Etihad. Is Man City one of them?
No, this is teams who played against Man City at the Etihad and not lost. One of them won, one of them drew. Basel, correct.
Yeah.
Good
one more.
Knowledge. Is it in Europe or the Premier League?
Neither.
Oh, League Cup.
Correct.
Wolves.
Technically, they lost on penalty.
Mm. Ah, yeah.
Don't get me started, Tom.
That can of worms.
I should have said it in 90 minutes.
Right. Okay. And by the way, while we're talking about Everton maybe not being the pushovers, etc. and so on, last season, how did it end when Man City came to town?
4-0.
4-0 to Everton. Pep Guardiola with his head in his hands at the final whistle. Wow. And of course, City, if we're talking about Liverpool, ahead of their clash with Crystal Palace, will have City on their mind. City presumably will also be looking forward to the Champions League game coming up midweek.
Yeah,
huge.
I mean, City's next four after going to Goodison, Liverpool away in the Champions League, then at home to United, potential league decider. Then the second leg of the Liverpool tie in the Champions League, and then they're away at Tottenham in the league. Although if they've won the league by then, I guess they won't care too much about that.
I guess not. Okay, one last update, and that is, Kelsey Grammer, if you're listening and saying, it's true, your wife, Katie Walsh, is the daughter of a former Bristol Rovers striker and now youth team coach, Mr. Walsh. And that's what the connection. That's what the connection is. So, well done to you. And anyway, that's our look at the football weekend. So let's get the odds on some of those exciting-looking games from Paddy Power with producer Ben.
Thank you, James. I'm here with Lee Price, as always. And Lee, coming up to the Easter weekend, the big fixture is Chelsea versus Spurs. Now, there were 9 players booked when they met in that very angry game at the end of the season before last. What price on at least one red card when they meet again?
Yeah, slightly less on this game than that infamous meeting, but both teams will be gung-ho for Champions League qualification. So, given that it's some sort of weird derby, although not quite, the traders have made this quite short. It's just 4-1 that the referee's dishing out cards like Easter eggs and someone gets a red one.
What about the money-back special that you're offering on this game?
Oh, it's a special one, all right. It's money-back as a free bet if Chelsea win, which applies to losing first, last, anytime goal scorers, correct score and what odds Paddy markets. Max refund £10, retail only.
What sort of value can we get elsewhere in the Premier League, Lee? Palace, they have this reputation as Liverpool's bogey team. I'm a Liverpool fan and Palace haven't been that bogey-ish recently. But what about them upsetting the Reds this weekend?
Yeah, they haven't been, but their main bogeyman, Wilfried Zaha, is back and back fit and in form. They haven't won without him this season, so he's just the sort of player who can strike fear into Liverpool defence, i.e. a quick one. But with Reds pushing for second place, we're convinced they'll win. And we go odds on that Liverpool win the game. Palace are 11-2 if you fancy the upset.
There's action at the other end of the table, of course. Probably the biggest game is West Ham versus Saints. Neither side going through a good time at the moment. This is West Ham's first game and first home game, of course, since all those angry fans came on against Burnley. What's going to happen here?
Yeah, this is a huge game, and that's just for the stewards. In the battle of uninspiring managers, Southampton can leapfrog West Ham, and we favour them to do so. They're 8-5 to win. The hosts are 9-5, so it's very tight. The draw, which helps nobody, by the way, is 21-10, and probably what's going to happen.
And in other relegation and chasing second place news, it's Swansea versus United. Now, the Swans used to have a great record against the Red Devils. That was generally when Louis van Gaal was around. Can Carlos Carvajal get the better of Jose Mourinho here?
Possibly. I mean, Carvajal has been more like Mourinho than Mourinho himself recently. He's been a throwback with the charm and slick dress sense and actually winning games. But I can't see him skidding down the Old Trafford touchline. United are humongous 1-5 on to win, with Swansea a distant 13-1. So if you fancy that, there's massive value there. But I wouldn't be expecting to see it come in.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. It is 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org, for goodness sake. When the fun stops, stop. And so we wrap up another Totally Football show. Many thanks to you, Tom Williams.
Thank you.
And James Horncastle.
Thank you very much, James.
And Michael Cox.
Thank you, and happy Easter.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Michael. So we'll be back, Easter notwithstanding, on Monday, when our guest will be Daniel Storey, Sasha Gurionov, making his long-awaited return, and also Matt Davis, who I think has got an important message for you coming up. See you on Monday anyway.
The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.
My name is Matt Davis. You know, the guy from Chelsea TV who supports Nottingham Forest and does the commentary of the Argentinian Premier League for Nigerian TV. And if, like me, you're the kind of listener who smiles knowingly every time Jimbo says, "It's gotta be Kane," or calls the new Roma prodigy Senghis under The Undertaker, then here's some news to brighten up your road to WrestleMania. Here we go! I've hurled the jabroni who used to host the Parts Unknown wrestling podcast through the barbershop window so that we can begin a new era. New guests, new music, new gimmick, new spandex. Parts Unknown begins on the first week of April with our WrestleMania preview show. And once we're done reviewing it 7 days later, we'll begin breaking down all the previous manias from 33-1 in our WrestleMania Rewind.
Oh yeah!
See, it's not just Serie A that deserves a nostalgia show. That's the Parts Unknown Wrestling Podcast with me, Matt Davis. Subscribe now on Acast, iTunes, and everywhere else you get your podcasts.